Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz pleaded with the people of his state today after another night of violent protests.
I'm asking you to help us. Help us use humane way to get the streets to a place where we can restore the justice so that those that are expressing rage and anger and demanding justice are heard, not those who throw firebombs into businesses.
Crowds in Minneapolis and a handful of cities nationwide have been protesting the death of George Floyd, a black man who died this week in Minneapolis after a police officer kneeled on his neck for several minutes. NPR's Layla Fadel is in Minneapolis and joins us now. Layla, first of all, what more can you tell us about what the governor said today?
Well, he really continued in that tone that we just heard, telling people that he understood that what's been happening in the Twin Cities is a manifestation of generations of pain now on display for the world after seeing another black man dying at the hands of a police officer. He was also pleading with people to help him and other officials restore calm as they separate protesters demonstrating their First Amendment right to express rage from people who are destroying businesses. He was also asked a number of times about what took the state so long to intervene when police evacuated that third precinct police station last night, responding, saying that he responded when local officials asked for state intervention. But there were very few actual answers of when it comes to the demands of the protesters, the demands that charges are brought against the police officer. And he also apologized for the brief arrest of a CNN reporter earlier in the day for the messaging that it might send that journalists couldn't cover this major event. So he apologized and took responsibility for that.
That was a stunning thing to watch because it happened while the reporter was live on the air. Now, you were outside the police headquarters today, the headquarters that rioters set fire to yesterday. What did you see?
Really, I saw people coming out from their homes, picking through the rubble, seeing what had happened to their neighborhood, their grocery store destroyed, the local Target destroyed, the Domino's food store. I saw advertising firm, a local advertising firm, still in flames, and a row of state patrol in riot gear blocking the road to the precinct. And right there, I met a woman named Maryam Hussein looking at her neighborhood, and this is what she said.
Is this one cop worth more than our city, our sanity, and our safety? Like, why is it taking so long to charge him? People just want him to be brought to justice.
You know, she said she's got a 14-month-old baby at home, that in this pandemic, all of these places, she depended on them to shop and be safe, and now she wonders what's next. And so she really wants something to be done because this rage will continue.
The U.S. Department of Justice said yesterday that an investigation into Floyd's death is a top priority. The Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison told CNN that there will be charges against the four officers involved. No charges yet, though. Where are we on that, on potential charges?
Right now, as we speak, like you said, no charges have been brought against any of those officers, including the officer filmed in the video pinning Floyd to the ground. Yesterday, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman asked for patience, saying his office needed to do this right. He added that besides the horrific video that we've all seen, he said there was also other evidence that does not support a criminal charge, and they're weighing all of that. So we're still waiting to hear when and if these charges will be brought.
And are we expecting more protests tonight or over the weekend?
More protests? Yes, we are expecting protests into the weekend. And as we've seen, they're spreading to other cities across the country. And we expect those to continue, especially without charges still on Friday when this happened Monday.
That is NPR's Layla Fadel in Minneapolis. Layla, thank you.
Thank you.
George Floyd's death is the most recent in a long history of violence and mistrust between police officers and black communities. Jennifer Eberhardt, a professor of psychology at Stanford University, conducted a multi-year study of police departments in the United States. She's also the author of Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We Think, See, and Do. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, so you've spent several years researching the psychological association between race and crime, and you found that there is a dehumanizing factor that plays a role in not only police interactions, but criminal court cases as well. Tell us more about some of the other facts you found in parsing out this data.
Yes, with a team of researchers, I found that the association between African Americans and crime is so powerful that just thinking about violent crime can lead people to focus their attention on Black faces. So, you know, in our studies, when we simply show police officers an image of a white face and a Black face, the Black face is much more likely to draw their attention when those officers are prompted to think of shooting, apprehending, capturing, or arresting. So this racial stereotype can lead Black people to be the subject of gaze, even as those stereotypes prevent Black people from being fully seen.
Yeah. You work with police departments to design interventions, as you call them. And we've been talking for so many years about implicit bias training. Your training was implemented by the Department of Justice in Oakland and Stockton, California. But we keep seeing incidents like what happened in Minneapolis happen. Is there any data to show these trainings that departments have received over the years is really working?
Yeah, and I mean, that's exactly the question you want to ask, is not just whether the trainings were implemented, but how those trainings are evaluated. And all too often, the trainings are not rigorously evaluated. And so we don't know oftentimes whether a procedural justice training worked or an implicit bias training worked or whether, you know, a bystander intervention training worked, for example. And so we want to actually understand that more and understand what factors lead these trainings to be more effective and less effective. Now, beyond, you know, simply training, you know, you want to put systems in place that reduce harm to communities. And some of that harm can come from bias and some of it can come from, you know, policies and enforcement practices that need to be reexamined.
I want to ask you about the officer who held George Floyd under his knee in Minneapolis. His name is Officer Derek Chauvin. He had 18 prior complaints, and we often hear about one bad apple. Is this an individual problem or a systemic problem based on your research?
We look at systemic problems, so we're not like focused in on a particular individual and their profile and their history. We're looking at how this plays out, more broadly. So in Oakland, California, you know, my Stanford colleagues, Benoit Monin and Hazel Marcus, and I work with a small task force in the Oakland Police Department. And the goal here was to reduce the number of stops they were making of people who were not committing any serious crime. And we settled on a simple approach to reducing stops, and that was to push officers to ask themselves a question before each and every stop they make. And that question was, is this stop intelligence-led, yes or no? And what they mean by intelligence-led is this, do I have prior information that ties this particular person to a specific crime? And we found that simply adding that checkbox to the form officers complete during a stop made a huge difference. In 2017, officers in Oakland made roughly 32,000 stops. This was before the checkbox was added. 2018, with the addition of that checkbox, they made around 19,000 stops. And African-American stops alone fell by over 43%. And that drop happened even as the crime rate continued to fall.
So what I'm hearing from you, what you're really getting at, is that racial bias can't be eliminated, but it can be managed.
Yes, it can be managed. And I think that's why, you know, this particular intervention worked, right? Because we pushed officers to slow down. We changed the standard they were using to evaluate others. And then the police leadership incentivized those stops. So we changed an enforcement practice in a manner that also decreased the potential for bias in officers' decision making.
So you were able to implement these interventions in Oakland and Stockton, but what about other parts of the country?
I mean, yes, departments differ in a lot of ways in their culture and in, you know, regional differences even. But there are, you know, some factors that can make, you know, a difference. You know, the first thing, if you want to sort of think about solutions and what do we turn to, I think a lot of people feel lost on this. And I think the first thing is to believe that change is possible. You know, we can use evidence-based approaches to improve police-community interactions and to maintain justice. And we've seen these approaches make a difference in Oakland, California. And we've also seen other promising approaches that are being tried across the country.
That's Dr. Jennifer Eberhardt, a professor of psychology at Stanford, recipient of the 2014 MacArthur Genius Grant, and author of Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
State and local officials continue to relax shutdown orders as the country records more than 100,000 deaths due to COVID-19, leaving many public health experts concerned about a second wave of infections. Let's bring in Dr. Rochelle Walensky. She's chief of infectious diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, when you look around the country with states relaxing their shutdown orders in many cases, where do you think we are in the curve of this pandemic? Has the U.S. reached its peak in terms of infections, or are we going to continue to see numbers rising?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And the implication is that the United States is a homogeneous space. And I think if we've learned one thing in the last 4 months, it's that there is a lot of heterogeneity, not only around the country, but around the states. So I live in Boston. We were, you know, the third hardest hit state. And we, I think, are dipping our toe into reopening because we really understand the implications of what would happen under another surge. We're being very, very careful. I think states that might not have seen what we have seen or experienced our last 3 months in the same way have been a little bit more liberal in terms of what they are opening and what they are allowing. I will admit that it is really concerning to me to see what is happening in terms of the mixing and the lack of mask wearing in some of the footage that I've seen. And I'm just hopeful that they won't experience what we have over the last several months.
Well, if they don't, and let's think about that video that went viral last weekend of people at the Lake of the Ozarks all having a huge party in the pool, nobody really wearing masks there. Do you expect that we're going to see a spike in a couple of weeks related to that? And if we don't, what does that tell you?
I would say I wouldn't be at all surprised if we saw a spike. If we do see a spike, it will convey that there were people there who likely had asymptomatic disease. If we don't, then I would say we got lucky. I think at this point, we know that there is still community spread of this virus. We certainly are not at the point where we have contained everybody who has it, that we know who they all are, and we've contact traced all of their, you know, contacts. So if we don't see a spread from perhaps that event, and people take that as permission to repeat those events, then I would say we would have to be extraordinarily lucky not to have people with disease in some of those spaces. For the most part, we believe that the peak of transmission can happen even up to a day before people have symptoms at all, even if people were going to get sick. So I think it's a bit of a roulette game. If we believe that events like the one that happened last week and that went viral are not going to lead to more events.
As more people resume parts of their daily lives that they maybe put on hold for the last few months, there is a lot of attention being paid to the question of immunity. A lot of people are operating under the assumption that you are immune if you've already had COVID-19. What is the latest on whether or not that's the case?
It's a really important question. First of all, I will say that we are learning a lot about serology testing. That's the test for the antibody. The antibody, in theory, will tell us if somebody is immune. There are different kinds of antibodies. So there may be antibody to the virus, but we don't know yet whether all of that antibody is protective, whether what we call it's neutralizing. Neutralizing antibody would protect you from a future infection with the virus. There are some people who believe that the people will have neutralizing antibody once they've been infected before. And there's evidence now in macaques and monkeys that that is true, but these are small numbers. We certainly don't know whether it's completely protective immunity or partial immunity. We don't know whether even if you had partial immunity, you might still be infectious enough to be able to give it to somebody else. And we certainly don't know anything about the duration of that immunity. So if you had two people who had had the one who had had the disease and one who had not had the disease, I would say it's probably more likely, given an exposure, that the person who hadn't had the disease would get it than the person who had. But I'm not willing to say then that the person who had the disease shouldn't be wearing a mask.
I got a note today from a friend who is an emergency physician who said we're entering trauma season as COVID cases increase, plus social distancing decreases, further increasing COVID, plus all the people who haven't been seeking care start coming out. Yeah. Our emergency department volumes are headed up, up, up. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I'm just so worried about, I'm worried about several things. One is the people who are now coming to care in our hospitals are sick. And they're not necessarily sick with COVID. They're sick with lack of care and attention and coming to care for the last 3 or 4 months. Our orthopedic surgeons are saying, they've done more amputations because people were not taking care of potential infections in their limbs. And so people are starting to present really, really sick. That is happening all the while summer is happening. People tend to be a little riskier with their behaviors and, you know, as they're outside and whatnot. So trauma season for sure. And then if we end up with another peak, I just really, you know, the coincidence of those three really scary peaks would really be devastating.
That is Dr. Rochelle Walensky, who's chief of infectious diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thousands of churches are planning to hold services this Pentecost Sunday, an important Christian holy day held 50 days after Easter. Religious services are no longer restricted in about half of the states, but some churches that have reopened have already seen COVID-19 outbreaks. One of those churches is the First Baptist Church in the town of North in South Carolina. It's about 30 miles outside of Columbia. The church is led by Pastor Shane McElrath. And Pastor McElrath, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show today.
Yes, so your church is closed now, correct? But it was open a few weeks before some members were exposed to the virus. Can you tell us what happened?
Sure thing. We've watched the progression of this virus, at least here in South Carolina. We felt about 3 weeks ago that the virus was declining and that we would be safe to resume in-person worship services if we, of course, would abide by the guidelines laid forth by the CDC. So 3 weeks ago, we did resume Sunday morning only worship. We had masks. We were advising folks to socially distance. We were providing gloves and hand sanitizer and making sure that our facilities were, of course, sanitized before the worship service.
And you found, even in doing all of that, that someone in your congregation might have had COVID-19 and 40 members exposed?
Unfortunately, that was the case. We received a phone call just this past Tuesday from the individual. The individual, of course, was not aware they were positive for the virus. They had merely went to be tested out of precaution. And so they were, of course, very alarmed, and they were very prompt in notifying the church so that we could start making the necessary precautions and advisements.
Yeah. And what are your advisements? What actions have you all taken?
Well, we understand the severity of this situation. So for starters, we've advised the folks who were in attendance this past Sunday to quarantine themselves, as the CDC is advising. And in addition to that, also going to get tested. We've received a lot of phone calls already from the folks who were in attendance, and a lot of them have thankfully taken that advice. Beyond that, we've made the decision as leadership of this local church to suspend in-person worship services for the month of June, only having online services. We just want to send the message to our people that we know that this is a severe sickness, and we want to protect them and also protect our community, because that's what a local church is called to do, is to serve, love, and protect its community.
I want to ask you more about that. There's sort of a battle brewing throughout the country over whether or not churches should open. In California, there were outbreaks that were traced to a Mother's Day service. In Arkansas, the CDC has linked 4 deaths to a church gathering back in March. Now that this is hitting so close to home in your church, what are your thoughts about some of the other congregations throughout the country who are taking this step and really strong in saying we should be open?
Well, I think, unfortunately, this is not a one-size-fits-all type scenario, and so each local church has to look at its community and even the surrounding communities and really try to make the best decision for them. There's certainly places throughout our country and throughout our states that are hot spots for this virus, and there's some spots who've yet to be affected. And so I think each congregation needs to be wise and prudent in making that decision on whether to resume services or whether to continue doing only online or whatever they've decided that works best for them.
Even in spite of the fact that you all have had this scare, you feel that it's up to the individual churches?
Well, I would, but I would also encourage other churches to really take a step back and make sure that they understand all sides of this situation. You know, we can take the greatest measures and put in place the strictest guidelines, but unfortunately, there'll be folks who are exposed to this. And so, I think that it's probably best for them to really look at their community and what's going on in terms of the numbers. And I think as businesses and different things continue to open, at least the danger is going to be there until this sickness, of course, is no more.
That's Pastor Shane McElrath speaking with us from the town of North in South Carolina. Pastor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
With just over 5 months left until the presidential election, let's check in on the advertising that's going on. There are independent groups like the Lincoln Project, a group of disaffected Republicans running ads like this one.
There's mourning in America. Today, more than 60,000 Americans have died from a deadly virus Donald Trump ignored. With the economy in shambles, more than 26 million Americans are out of work.
That ad, which you can tell by the numbers, aired a while ago, was aired on Fox News during Tucker Carlson's show, specifically in the Washington, D.C. market, so that President Trump would see it, and he did. His reaction on Twitter gave the ad rocket fuel. Less attention, though, has gone to ads run by the Trump and Biden campaigns. Joining us to remedy that is Here and Now media analyst John Carroll. John, give us an overview of ad spending in the presidential race.
Sure. Analysts predict that ad spending during the 2020 election cycle will top $6.5 billion. About $2.2 billion will be spent on the presidential general election. Roughly half of that will go to broadcast TV spots, about a third to digital ads, and the rest to cable ads with some pocket change thrown at radio.
And we haven't seen many broadcast TV ads so far, have we?
No, not much, although the Trump campaign earlier this month did spend about $10 million on 2 TV spots, one of which attacked Joe Biden. The other provided a sort of alternative narrative to the Lincoln Projects.
Well, let's hear some of that ad.
Together, we're beating back the invisible enemy.
What the federal government did was a phenomenal accomplishment.
Through it all, the world has witnessed the unyielding resolve of our incredible American people.
So that ad was on TV, but outside of that, the real action is happening online. The Biden campaign released a digital ad focusing on President Trump's preparedness for the pandemic. Let's listen.
Joe Biden warned the nation in January that Trump had left us unprepared for a pandemic. Then, Biden told Trump he should insist on having American health experts on the ground in China.
I would be on the phone with China and making it clear, we are going to need to be in your country.
So that was a digital ad. No TV ads yet for the Biden campaign.
No, Joe Biden's all online so far. He's spent about $8 million over the past couple of months. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign and its allied Make America Great Again committee have spent about $21 million on ads.
Now, after Joe Biden said on the Breakfast Club radio show last week that if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or for Trump, then you ain't black, the Trump campaign spent $1 million attacking him online. Is that where the focus will be for ads this cycle, online?
Certainly, the focus will be online. The question is, what will the topic be? Trump hasn't spent much money on Facebook ads, for instance, attacking or even talking about Joe Biden, where Biden has spent about $6 million talking about Trump. Most of Trump's ads are direct response ads. They are looking to basically raise money or gather data. They use hot-button issues like immigration, so-called fake news, to get those kinds of responses.
And, John, can you tell from the data where the Trump campaign is advertising? Are they location-specific?
They are. And surprisingly, Trump is running a lot of digital ads. Swing states he won in 2016, like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. He hasn't gone into states he thought he could turn from blue to red. That indicates he's playing defense, not offense.
That is John Carroll, media analyst for us at Here and Now. John, thanks.
Thank you.
A heat wave has taken over parts of California, and with it, the threat of fire. It's a reminder that this could be a busy summer ahead for fire crews battling wildfires, while also juggling new challenges posed by COVID-19. Joining us now is Tom Porter, who is chief of California's Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, also known as Cal Fire. And Chief Porter joins us from outside of the Capitol in Sacramento. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tanya. It's good to be back.
Yes. So how have your crews been impacted by the coronavirus? And what contingency plans are you thinking about during this pandemic?
Thank you for asking that. And we've been looking at broadly, how do we respond to wildland fire? We have large camps that we set up in different places where it's difficult to keep people physically distanced from each other. So we've made plans to feed and keep people physically distanced when they're eating. Crews that are what I'll call kind of a family unit or a crew unit will be monitoring each other and themselves and staying in those crew units. And we've been at this for months now. We have not had any significant COVID infections in Cal Fire's employees. Yeah. So I don't anticipate that we're going to maintain that same stature throughout the season, but we are doing quite well at keeping our people healthy and ready to respond throughout California as it speaks.
This is a major undertaking because we know that those traditional base camps can hold upwards of 6,000 firefighters. And if we're talking about a major fire event, it is really a tricky kind of process to go through to try to keep all of the firefighters at a socially safe distance.
Yes. And interestingly, with the large fires we've been having in the last several years, it's forced us to look at things in a different way, which are going to help this type of response now. So we had, in some cases, three base camps, and then we were simulcasting and sharing our incident briefings digitally between those different camps. So this is forcing us to really embrace technology in a way that we just haven't had the need to do, but also leveraging some of the experience that we were forced to do because of geography in the recent past.
Can I ask you about funding? How concerned are you about firefighting funding going forward and implementing some of these technological fixes during this time of COVID-19?
Yeah, so funding is something of a concern. This COVID response at the state level has flexed the budget in ways that we weren't anticipating 6 months ago.
You know, last fire season, many of the gas and electric companies had to cut service to lessen the potential for sparking fires. I'm thinking about now that we're in the midst of this pandemic, there's an added weight of cutting people's service when they need it most. You know, I know you're in the firefighting business, so it's all about really keeping people safe. But are these the kinds of hard conversations that you all are having?
Yes, very much so. And actually, this weekend, we're expecting our first what we call public safety power shutdowns, PSPS, on the east side of the Sierras. Southern California Edison has a warning that they might be doing just that. And so we're in it, and we are working closely with our counterparts in the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, that's CalOES, to be prepared. And what prepared means for me as the state's wildland fire department is different than those that are going to have to manage cooling stations and or charging and resource stations where people can go to either get cool, get power, get resources that they need that they can't obtain at home. All of that has been something that we learned many lessons last year from.
Yeah.
But the utilities are still utilizing that technique as a way of reducing the chance of starting a fire.
Right. And so much to think about, too, when it comes to those cooling centers and also the centers for shelters in case of a fire. All of the social distancing rules that we were just talking about that you're working through with your firefighters. That's Tom Porter. He's chief of California's Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, also known as CAL FIRE. Thank you so much, Chief, for giving us this update.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for thinking of us. And I always look forward to talking to you again.
Well, with businesses large and small gradually and cautiously reopening in many states, there's a moment some of you may have been waiting for, a chance to step back inside of your favorite cafe or restaurant. From member station KUOW, Ruby DeLuna reports what we can learn from communities there moving forward. And since she's in Seattle, she begins with a coffee shop.
Starbucks plans to reopen 85% of its shops this month, so I decided to check out the Central District store in Seattle. It used to be busy and a favorite hangout for cabbies. When I drove up, there were no lines. Here's what else I saw.
There's a specific door for entering and a different one for exiting, and it looks like this shop has adjusted its hours. It opens at 7:30 and closes at 2, so it looks like it has limited hours. Here we go.
When you walk in, the music is playing just like before. But don't expect to sit down because there's no cafe seating. The store is set up for to-go orders only. All the baristas and workers are wearing masks. A staff asks me if I have a mobile order.
No, I don't. Is it okay if I order here?
Well, okay this time. But during this phase, customers are encouraged to order ahead with a mobile app or use drive-through where available. Starbucks is taking what it calls a monitor-and-adapt approach to reopening. It'll be different for each store. In a letter to staff, company leaders say these decisions are based on ensuring worker and customer safety. They say they're confident with this approach and point to their success in reopening shops in China, where the outbreak first started. The company says today about 98% of the stores there are back in operation. Other cities like Hong Kong have similar experiences.
You're still at home, are you?
Yeah, sure am.
Not moved anywhere.
My sister Rahina has lived in Hong Kong for 20 years. Hong Kong had to deal with the outbreak before the U.S., so I thought hearing her experience there could shed some light on what life could be like here in the foreseeable future. She says right now, eating out requires a few steps before you can come in and get seated.
When you go in, you come in with a mask, they take your temperature, they give you a squirt of hand sanitizer. And then a lot of, I think if not all of them, make you sign a declaration that you've not been out of the city for the last 14 days, have had contact with anyone who's been out of the city for the last 14 days.
During the outbreak, food businesses in Hong Kong continued to operate. Even so, people were wary and stayed home. When cases were rising again, leading to a second wave, the government imposed restrictions. Restaurants were open at half capacity, and each table was limited to four diners. Rahina says having eateries being half full was a welcome change, especially for a dense city like Hong Kong.
It's kind of a luxury for Hong Kong because you're usually crammed in. So it's nice that way.
My sister says things are slowly easing up. She also notes that some restaurants have started providing amenities to accommodate the new normal.
They provide you with these little bags to put your face mask in so that it just doesn't sit on the table, which is kind of gross when you think about it. If, you know, technically the mask is contaminated and you don't put it on the table. So they provide you with these little cute paper bags. So I thought that's a nice touch.
I tell my sister where we here in Seattle are in the lockdown. It'll likely be June before people can dine in again at restaurants, which is phase two under Washington Governor Jay Inslee's reopening plan.
How does it feel to go out and eat these days? I mean, when we eat out, it's usually about socializing, that sort of thing. Do you get that same vibe too when you're going out these days?
No, it hasn't been that way. It's more like, you know, you get your fix, but you don't linger, you know. I think it'll be a while before people necessarily will do that.
That could very well be another phase here in our transition to normal. For Here and Now, I'm Ruby DeLuna in Seattle.
New York City has been the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak in the United States, in part because of its density and large population. And with shelter in place and social distancing guidelines, New Yorkers have been stuck spending a lot of time in their apartments, which, and I say this from personal experience, can be quite small. So some New Yorkers are taking this opportunity to leave the city, maybe for good. Joining us now is Allison Bernstein, who's the founder and president of the Suburban Jungle Group. That's a company that helps people relocate from the city to the suburbs. Allison, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And what has demand been like at your company since the coronavirus outbreak began?
So we have seen a massive spike in business. We are currently up over 300% for the same time period during this sort of what we call the pandemic time frame thus far.
And what are people telling you about why they're leaving?
There are several factors in place. You know, I think the first is we typically tend to work, you know, with people kind of in that phase of life of young families. They have young children. So, you know, the city was really never meant to be lived in an apartment. You know, you live in an urban environment because you love, you know, all the amenities of the city, whether it be, you know, the culture, the parks, you know, and all of that has been taken away, obviously. And, you know, more importantly, indefinitely. So when you lose those amenities, you're really kind of stuck in your apartment. And as you mentioned, you know, it's not ideal. It's just not what urban living was meant for. So the combination of being stuck in an apartment and also the young families, the fear of even leaving the apartment with young children, they're touching everything. Mm-hmm. They're pulling their face masks off. So it's a struggle to even get outside. Another factor that we've seen is this, you know, obviously work from home, which is going to be a bigger trend moving forward. You know, these apartments, you know, a lot of our families are in two-bedroom apartments with two kids, and now you have two people working from home, or even one person, whoever it may be. It's so tight with young children. It's just all of those things are pushing people out.
Well, and the other thing is, on the issue of working from home, is if you don't have to be in New York to go to your office, you have more freedom to live somewhere else, maybe pay a lot less for what you're getting, and work from home in New Jersey or Connecticut or something.
Absolutely. We've been seeing this trend for the last several years because we've noticed that even if people are not going fully remote, they are more flexible with the days in the office. And so, you know, the trends that we've seen are people are willing to go a little bit further out. They're not as, you know, married to that commute. But now, you know, with all of these companies going fully remote, you know, whether it's Facebook or Twitter, or some of the larger banks are even talking about it, it's really making people think about what their lifestyle really should be. And so we've seen a massive spike in our South Florida office. Because people are saying, hey, even if I have to be in the office, you know, once every 2 weeks, it's still a better quality of life and less expensive and the tax incentives in Florida. Then, so they're looking at it holistically, not just in the suburbs, but where can I really live and enjoy my life?
Well, and I want to say I totally love New York. I loved living in New York. I think when it works, it is like just a great place to be. And as you mentioned, there are culture and parks and restaurants and just things you can't find anywhere else. But as you look at where people are going, you mentioned Florida. Are they moving in and around the New York area if they're leaving New York, or are they moving to Los Angeles or Texas or whatever?
Great question. You know, it's a very individual decision. You know, I think there are a lot of factors that come into play. So obviously the quality of life, the cost of living, but also family. Do you need to be closer to family? Are you kind of relocating back to where you originally were from and you came to the New York area because of, you know, a career opportunity? A lot of people are in this position where we don't really know what the world is going to look like post-pandemic, right? We don't know what, you know, what jobs are going to look like. And so I think a lot of people are making these decisions, kind of thinking lifestyle, where my family is, you know, and those things. So a lot of people are staying in the New York area. And if they are, they're making those decisions based on other criteria. And other people say, you know, this is a great opportunity for us to pick up and go where we've always wanted to.
It must be pretty difficult right now to relocate because it's harder to go have an open house, check out different places where you want to live, et cetera, because of COVID-19.
I think, you know, we've been super creative, just like everybody has been, you know, that's currently dealing with working in this time period. And, you know, we do a lot of caravan tours, FaceTime tours. You know, we've had a lot of deals happen over FaceTime, and ultimately people will be able to go and inspect the home and see it and make sure. And I think, you know, it's become more efficient. You know, you can do and visit, you know, for us, you know, we're very much a town first approach. You can do FaceTime tours and really see the details of a town and what the schools look like, you know, from the comfort of your own living room.
Do you think that there's any element of white flight to this, as we saw decades ago when wealthier and whiter families ended up leaving cities and going out to the suburbs at a moment like this?
Interesting. I, you know, it's hard. I always go back to, this is still brand new. It's still too early to determine what the true trends are going to be. I think that from what we're, you know, hearing from the people that had second homes, you know, they're sitting in the, you know, in their homes in the Hamptons or Hudson Valley or, you know, some of the suburbs, and they're saying, you know, I'm going to wait this out. I love the city. I'm going to go back. The people that are stuck in the city right now are telling a very different story. They're stuck, they're trapped, and they don't really know when this is going to clear up. So to be determined.
That is Allison Bernstein, who is the founder and president of the Suburban Jungle Group, which helps people relocate from the city to the suburbs. Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, New York's governor said today the city is on track to reopen the week after next. Stay tuned. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.